Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times, where Premier League fans can get every goal, every game, everywhere, except during the Saturday mandated blackout period of 2:45 to 5:15 p.m., which is not a UEFA rule. It's a Premier League rule, English rule, whatever it is. Do not blame UEFA for it. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by three of the most jingoistic England lovers in journalism. A Yorkshireman who has a weird fetish for Uruguay, a man with a South London accent who played for the Republic of Ireland, and, well, a Scot. I apologize. It seems entirely incongruous we couldn't find an England fan to come on this show where we talk about England. But hey, who says we're not objective at all times? All right, let's get started. England and Moldova, since I am clearly the biggest England fan here. No surprises, right, Johnny?
No, not really. I mean, Moldova, I was trying to think if I've seen a worse international team play against England at Wembley, apart from, you know, your obvious Andorras and San Marinos, and I don't think I have, because, I mean, Moldova, you know, when you're a small team, you might expect to, at the very least, compete in some way physically. They weren't, you know, they weren't that. They didn't have, you know, the one sort of half-decent player that a small country sometimes does. They just had nothing. So, you know, it's a very easy game for England. They appeared to play quite well, England, but it was hard to know given the opposition. 4-0 was probably par for the course.
What, you know, if you're like one of those teams where sort of, okay, you know, you hope for the miracle and then it'll be like 8 games or 10 games in the group. And after 4 or 5 games, you kind of know that you're not going to qualify. Does your mentality change? Do you as a manager start calling different people in? Do you say, look, let's just try to play properly rather than win? Do you know what I'm saying? Maybe I'm giving Moldova an out here.
Mm. Well, what's pretty clear and what's happened with Ireland in the last few days is that Trapp now is the whole of Ireland has accepted he's going. And I've been part of a campaign. I first started with Ireland in the early 80s and we had Owen Hand. And we had 3 games to go and we lost 4-1 at home to Denmark. And it was just the way it was. He would be leaving the post. And now it was like, oh, we pick up the pieces. The players are left now. We've got to put in a performance because we've not been good enough. And in some ways, it was quite a relief.
Liberating?
Liberating. We found, you know, the players went out and had to prove ourselves as players and men that we could unite and get something extra out of the team. And I've been part of that. But it's very, very difficult, Gab, because there is a... I know what the feeling would be with Ireland players this week. After they lost on Friday, it'd be like, get us back to England and get us back to our clubs and let's get away. Try and do a performance in Austria. It's a real tricky one because you know you're only going to get flak and the flak just doesn't stop coming. And you can magnify that if it was England. Think of when England have had a bad time. It's magnified 10 times.
Can you clarify that about the flak, though? Sorry. People do care. Like just because.
Oh, absolutely, Gab. Yeah. It's not a case of don't caring.
No, but I'm saying like the media and stuff, like when you've been bad for a long time, like they don't just sit there and wait for the cycle to finish. They just keep criticising and criticising. Yeah. Is that what happens?
Well, you know Eamon Dunphy, don't you?
What? Yeah, it's true.
Eamon's not stopped for 25 years.
But I'd have said that Ireland and Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland are kind of on a different level to teams like Moldova because, yeah, they're not going to qualify.
Scotland?
Yeah, even Scotland. But I say that as someone who supports Scotland and Uruguay. No, I would have said that the Scots and the Welsh will start the qualification campaign sort of thinking, as you say, if we get a couple of good results, if we get an easy draw, if whoever the best side in our group aren't up to it, they'll start thinking, maybe we could do it. And it'll take them 5 or 6 games, or in Scotland's case about 3, to work out that they can't qualify. And at that point, you do get the experimental sides come in and maybe the energy levels drop. teams like Moldova, I find really interesting, because we have this debate about whether they should be allowed to be in qualification. Has anyone asked them what it's like for them? Does that must be pretty disheartening for the Moldovans. I think the smaller nations should be in the qualifying stages. I don't see that you should have a two-tier kind of system. But it must get pretty tough for Moldova, knowing that it's all kind of meaningless.
See, there's a little moment in the press conference after the England game where the Moldovan coach so very solemnly said, oh, well, you know, England played well, but we made mistakes for at least three of the goals. And at that point, I thought, you know, actually, that fella's going to go back and try and work on a few things, and maybe they do care. And, you know, I can sort of see this other side of it for just one moment. But I also thought, well, where does he start?
Well, with the goalkeeper, he drops the goalkeeper. Yeah. That's where he starts. Because I was at the under-21s on Thursday night when England played Moldova as well. And I don't know whether it was on purpose or whether it was kind of happenstance. The Moldovan under-21s keeper was brilliant. He made four or five properly top-class saves. That may have been a fluke, or it may have been bad finishing, but I'm fairly sure that Nemastro, his international career should really be just about at an end.
From somebody whose career, Roy, as the Creed, should be at an end, even though this guy is a professional, makes a living off it, and might even have a family.
His international career, I don't mind him playing for Dacia Chisinau.
All right. And somebody whose international career has reached 100 caps, Frank Lampard. Now, he's one, obviously, of a group of England players of this generation that reached 100 caps, and I was struck by this, John. I'm going to put it to you. Most of the world looks at that group of players and they say, these guys were exceptionally good. And people, I think, will talk about Lampard and Gerrard and Ashley Cole in those terms as being ridiculously good players, far better than any England players, you know, from, or maybe not all of them, far better than any England players from the 90s and 80s. But frankly, you know, you see the 80s, you say, give me Robson Hoddle. The 90s, you give me Paul Ince. I give you Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard. Match that.
Yeah, I'll give you another couple. You know, I mean, the worst squandering of talent I think I've seen from England was the period when Paul Scholes was still around as well.
And yeah, he was pretty good too, wasn't he?
He was all right, wasn't he? And you know, Beckham was, whether we think he was as good as people, you know, blah, blah, blah. He was a decent player, wasn't he? But when they had the four of them, it still didn't work. And maybe that's where the whole muddled thinking of English football comes out, because to not get four players like that functioning somehow in a midfield was criminal. But of course the problem is trying to play them all at the same time and just stringing four central midfielders out in a line and not thinking of anything more imaginative to do, whether it was, you know, three in midfield with the Scholes in a different position.
Okay, I sense a rant coming on. Do you remember, you guys remember when Ericsson decided to try and play them in a diamond? And I had to pick up the freaking English media, which I am a part of, sadly. People are like, what is this? What is this diamond formation? No, 4-4-2. What is this weird, exotic diamond formation? And I thought to myself, why don't you learn your own history? 1966.
Yeah. Yep.
What was England's formation then?
4-2-4.
Okay, fancy pants. It was Nobby Styles sitting in front of the back four. It was the wingless wonders. It was a diamond. It was exactly...
It was a 4-2-2-2.
Okay, thank you. The 4-2-2-2 is a weirdo South American invention. But yes, you can call it what you like, but it was essentially a diamond. And you could have done that with these players. And it wasn't so weird and foreign. If it wasn't for the fact that you had the dark ages of football and journalism in this country in the 1980s, which pushed everybody to forget all the good things that had happened in this country, and you guys did invent the game. I keep saying you guys, but hey, look, it's an Irishman and a Scot, and whatever. Well,
the other crazy thing with that, Gab, is, you know, England had just had Hoddle and Venables. Now, they weren't flat 4-4-2, men. You know, but it was as if that wasn't observed one bit. I mean, Hoddle, I thought, had a great midfield, but he had Anderton and McManaman as his wide players, and they didn't play as wingers, did they? But that just seemed to pass a lot of people by, and certainly when Sven came back and went back to his sort of 4-4-2, and it just became all about that again.
Do you not think that the whole problem with Scholes, Gerrard, Lampard, and kind of to a lesser extent Beckham, because you could play Beckham as a right winger and it's not like he was bad as a right winger, is that we've always had in this country these sceptred isles, so I can say we rather than they, referring to the English, kind of see it as being an international team is you get your 11 best players and you put them on the pitch. Mm. That's not how it works. An international team has to be the best team. So if you look at Italy in 2006, they won that World Cup because they decided that you couldn't play Totti and Del Piero together. So they played one of them, and lo and behold, it worked. Whereas before that, they tried to play both of them at all times, or do that weird combination thing.
See, as much as good as they were, and they're all very, very good individuals, I would wouldn't say any of them are blisteringly quick. You know, if you look at them as wide men, Beckham, he wasn't a guy that was going to blisteringly quick like a Walcott would do and make a huge difference. They had huge qualities. But I did feel at certain times that midfield would be quite ponderous at times. And if you were going to play Lampard and Scholes, neither of them, Gerrard's quick enough, but the two of them was never fantastic technically. There's no doubt. But England never, for that period, had anybody on the left side, did they?
No.
The whole problem, how many times did us guys talk about the left side of England's midfield?
But that was only a problem because we were rooted to 4-4-2. If you play a different formation, exactly. That's not an issue.
And also because you out of all those guys, you only had only one of those people was even remotely two-footed. And that goes into coaching and so on. I guess what I feel kind of bad of is somebody who's not English and frankly could care less is that I kind of grew up with these people, like Lampard and Gerrard. Lampard was my neighbour for a while, in fact.
You earned too much money if Frank Lampard was your neighbour.
He's a silver spoon kid.
I know. Yeah, right.
Anyway, we had the same local. the point I'm making here is that I think it's a combination of horrible FA and, again, I don't want to be in the media, we're part of it, everybody's got different ideas, goodness knows, we all have wrong opinions. But some of this absolute garbage, and I look at it also in terms of how far we've come. You remember when Sir Alex signed, and you remember this, Johnny, when Sir Alex signed Varane, and he started messing around and he played like the 1+1 up front.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these people, why isn't he playing 4-4-2? I think there was one game where at Old Trafford, the whole crowd started chanting 4-4-2, like it was some kind of mystical thing. I remember I had the privilege of talking to Sir Alex, and he mentioned some Scottish obscenities, and then he said, I've never played 4-4-2 in my life. I've always played 1+1. And yous in the media are so thick that you never realized it.
Gab, you know, it's music to my ears because I watched the Aberdeen team where on the right side of the midfield there was Gordon Strachan. He was Aberdeen's playmaker, but he was stationed wide, came in, nobody picked him up. They had two runners in midfield and then they had a left winger. It was 1+1 up front. It was a very...
Joey Harper.
Well, Joey Harper was just before the great team, but yeah, he was Joey Harper, Stevie Archibald was your first 1+1, and then it was Eric Black, Mark McGee, and this was sort of proper sort of forward-looking tactics, and I just think looking with the Lampard and Gerrard thing, everyone's talking about they can't play together. I mean, they couldn't play together as two central midfielders, but you know it was only in the last couple of years England thought of trying them in a three, and lo and behold, it looks okay.
The one thing I would say on that is that this big debate, are you trying to get Lampard and Gerrard into the same team and Strolls and all that? If you took them now, say the Strolls of two years ago, kind of towards the tail end of his career, with Gerrard of this season, who's sitting much deeper, who's playing a much more controlled kind of game, you could play them two as the sitting two and Lampard further forward, and you would have a very, very good midfield.
Okay. I actually put the Lampard-Gerrard point in there as a joke. It was a reference to our former colleague, Paddy Barclay, who, you know, often talked about it. I thought it was weird that we're having Lampard-Gerrard debates like 12 years after they first played together. But Cass, you made a point. Gerrard at centre half. You write about it in the paper.
Yeah.
You've got a little soapbox to tell us why it's a good idea, and then Smith and Northcroft can tell you how right you are or how wrong you are.
Well, I've always felt, over the last probably 5 years, that there's been a certain number of midfielders, and I've watched. I mean, even going back to 99 when I watched Luther Matthäus, who I played against as a midfielder, and he played centre-half for Bayern in the Champions League final. And I've seen quite a number of midfielders.
He was in a back three, though.
Yeah, but still in a back line. But I mean, Stephen's capable of playing anywhere. You know, he's that good. And he's also got a defensive quality as a midfielder. Very few teams play two up front. We'll go with that. They'll have a playmaker and leave one. So he's not going to be, you know, expected to do what Michael Carrick's had to do against Fellaini when Everton played Man United. You remember when Everton kept going from forward last year and frying the ball down Carrick? He's not going to be expected. I think his ability on the ball to see things early in a position like Gerard Pique has done for Barcelona, he does it brilliantly. He hits early balls to people so often that I just feel that he's nearly played as a centre-half in some strange way against Moldova. The other day he was sitting in front of back four picking up everything. I just think in the game there was an absolute place for me for Stephen to be able to do that job and do it comfortably. He's got great stride. I mean, the Champions League final against AC Milan where he played as a fullback, he was so good as a fullback. You came away thinking, this kid can play absolutely anyway.
And it was nearly 9 years ago, but
But he's still quick enough, Gab.
Yeah. No.
You know, he's got defensive qualities as well. And I think the biggest thing for me is he sees things so early that he splits defences, and wide men would appreciate it, and midfielders would have too, because he gives it some so quickly. And I think it's a position he could easily play for England.
Yeah, I mean, my concern would be if he doesn't play that position at club level, you risk the transition. On the other hand, if England centre half...
Well, I watched Big Paul McGrath do it week in, week out. Play centre half, play midfield, play centre half.
Did you tell me Paul McGrath was the best centre half you ever played with as well?
He was up there with one of the best, yeah.
Isn't he an absolute monster?
Yeah, he's a monster, but you see him in midfield? He was an unbelievably gifted player, Paul, that could see things and do things. Very few touches, very few.
I defer. Anyway. You see more of him. I didn't think he was an extremely skillful midfielder. Maybe in the English game, the way it was at the time. I mean, he was a phenomenal player and a great holding midfielder. I wouldn't necessarily
anoint. You never see him against England at Wembley when he played against Brian Robson?
I didn't. Sorry, I was a child at the time.
I was in the game. I'm being biased. Go on. Yeah.
But a great defender.
On Gerrard, Cass has explained that theory to me before, and I think it has a lot of merit. The one thing I would say...
But. There's a but coming up.
No, there's not a but. I think he's right, but... There's the but. Gerrard has got... He's coped better with ageing as a midfielder than I thought he would. Mm-hmm. And this season for Liverpool, last year to an extent, he's much calmer, he's much more composed. He's not trying to be a sort of a shadow of the old Steven Gerrard. He's become a different sort of player. And I think at the moment, he still has a lot to offer in midfield for both club and country.
Looking at qualification, obviously, Welbeck picked up, a stupid booking, a really stupid booking. It didn't matter that it was fair or unfair, but obviously now he's suspended and Sturridge is injured and Rooney has a big gash on his head. So I guess it'll be Ricky Lambert up front. It's Ukraine away. Johnny, the conventional wisdom is that as long as you don't lose in Ukraine, you're okay. Otherwise, Ukraine have a very, very easy run-in. England have, I believe, two home games left, but they're against Montenegro and against Poland. If you lose against Ukraine, you no longer control your destiny. And then things could get ugly. Nobody believes that's going to happen, right?
I mean, this debate about whether England should go and play for a draw or try and win, you kind of talk about teams who are capable of controlling games or have got options when you ask if they're going to make choices like that. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I don't think England are good enough to go there thinking about anything other than, you know, playing as best as they possibly can and accepting that they're going to have to defend for quite a large period of that game and see what comes out of it. I think nothing's guaranteed even after that result because I think, as you allude to, Ukraine are a great run of form, four wins in a row, and they've got a sort of emerging team now. You know, the Shevchenko blocking era is finally behind them, but they don't look like an absolute banker to win their, I think it's Poland they've got at home. You wouldn't absolutely...
Poland at home, San Marino away. Poland are basically eliminated. I mean, I think we can assume that they're going to.
But there's
run
a local,
the table, right?
There's a local derby element to them playing Poland at home, and you know Poland are decent enough. And I wouldn't. Well, I guess what I'm saying is I wouldn't say Ukraine are any more of a banker to beat Poland at home than England are to beat Poland at Wembley. It's just it's a mediocre group, and because new teams taking control of it. Even after this game on Tuesday, we're still going to have to look at the last two games. All that said, Ukraine are in the best position. England can't afford, obviously, to lose. And even a draw, I don't think really... If England do draw tomorrow, I would bet on playoffs rather than winning the group.
I sort of feel that maybe, again, going back to the Liverpool days when Roy Hodgson was at the club, that sometimes his approach to games would be very conservative, and I think he has no option really.
Well,
with
look
that
at him
tomorrow.
Look at him at Euro 2012. I mean, I thought that was one of the most horrible England teams I've seen in a long time. Not everything was good because all the people follow the national team. Oh, look, ding dong, the evil Capello is dead, and look,
it worked against Ukraine in that tournament, but only by a fluke. I mean, you know, they actually scored, didn't they? And they battered England.
Well, he's in a bit of a no-win situation on Tuesday because of
unless
the...
Unless he wins.
Well, no, because of the forward situation. You know, he's got very few people to choose from, and he's running out of numbers, so he's got every excuse to overload the midfield and try and scramble a result. And I suspect that's what will be intention. It'll be probably Milner will come in one side and do his brilliant air and up and down job and a real workmanlike performance and grind something out of for England. And I suspect that's what it will be.
Has Milner played much for City?
No, he's on the bench.
Has he come on?
He's come on, yeah.
It seemed like an unnecessary gamble to give the first start of the season in a game like this, to as good as Milner, as reliable as he can be.
I think Johnny's right. Whatever happens, I'm not sure you can call the group. Ukraine-Poland is a rivalry. I think the Poles aren't completely out of the equation yet. But the kind of telling thing is that, and I know we're coming on to Greg Dyke, because I've seen the running order, but he sort of got criticised for not saying that England might win the World Cup in 2014 or the Euros in 2016 or whatever. We're debating whether England should go and defend against a Ukraine team that is not the best Ukraine team that has existed in the last 4 years. This is where England are. Do you know what I mean? Then there has to be a realisation of England's place in the world.
On that transition point, let's move on.
Magnificent.
To Dyke. For people who don't know, Greg Dyke is a former television executive. Why do all these like FA types... Why are so many of them TV guys? Because Barrick was a TV guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Crozier's advertising, same difference.
Davis.
Yes.
Yeah.
You had those guys, then you had what? A mathematician,
Palios was an accountant, wasn't he?
Ugh, an accountant?
I mean, the themes are TV and money, aren't they?
Yeah. Does Bernstein have a day job, or was he always a football guy?
He was a businessman, wasn't he? He was an entrepreneur of some sort, I think.
I digress. But Dyke has a long history in football and television, and if you go back... you will find certain things. I was having a conversation with our boss, Tony Evans, who was obviously correct. You know, this is somebody who was involved way back in the 1980s and potentially creating a breakaway league of 10 teams, who's kind of been there all along, obviously involved with Brentford later in his career, not as somebody bankrolling the club, but was he honorary chairman, I think he was. Mm. My early impression, Johnny, and I want to give you first crack at this because you wrote about it the weekend, is that he reminds me a little bit of Michel Platini in the sense that he's like a big picture, big ideas, populist man. But sometimes he seems to speak without thinking and certainly speak without working out the details.
This is his management style. And if you look at what he did at the BBC, it was quite similar where, you know, he made kind of big picture statements and sort of tried to stir up the organisation and then, you know, sort of sat back and looked for change. That's one style. He's very sort of charismatic and tells it as it is, no nonsense when he's speaking. And I have to say, I was at a speech and I actually quite enjoyed just the act of listening to him, because he's a man you can listen to. But he plainly hasn't scrutinised any kind of detail, and I think it's going to come down to how serious, like all these FA things, how serious is this? Is this a PR exercise? Is this a surface?
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloane Stephens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloane.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Sort of look at things, or is this, you know, is this going to be a really serious attempt? And is this commission that he holds, is it going to be, you know, is it going to be all sort of Hollywood with Beckham arriving at Wembley in a helicopter, or is it going to be a proper attempt to speak to people in the game and look at some of the problems? And I suspect very, very quickly, if not already, he will know that when it comes to youth development, there's very little the FA can do, because that's in the gift of the clubs. So he has to look at doing other things. And the things he's talked about already, things like work permits and the loan system, quotas are a non-starter. I mean, they're all things around the margins. If they want to do something fundamental, then, you know, it's got to start what the FA can actually do, which would be coaching and facilities. But this comes back to what the pointless exercise is. When you start tackling things like those, which is what England need to do, you're not talking about a 2022 World Cup. You're talking about, you know, 2030 or something. And you're also not talking about something glamorous and eye-catching. And initially, you're talking about sort of hard work at the grassroots, which, you know, he'll be long gone before anyone gets any credit for. So it's going to be interesting, and I'm trying not to be cynical in advance.
Let's try not to be cynical here, and I do mean this. And one of the things that strikes me is when people start talking about winning the World Cups and things like that, I'd want to throw out, is success for the England men's national team, should that be the benchmark on which the FA is judged? It takes a lot of luck to actually win things. It's a short tournament. Things can go wrong and things can go right, and the best team often doesn't actually win. Maybe the focus shouldn't be on success for the England team. Maybe the focus should be either on having more coaches, which will help you produce more players in the long run, even if it does mean, as Johnny says, you're not going to get the credit. Or maybe, and this is what makes me a bit uneasy, is that people also keep bringing up this argument about the playing fields. But the point being is the FA's remit football for everybody? But if that's the case, then that means doing stuff which isn't necessary for the national game, because that means doing stuff for women's football. It means doing stuff for kids and even adults who want to play football. And we'll never play for England. You know, people who are differently abled and people who are too fat or too thin or too stupid to ever be professional footballers.
Surely they go hand in hand. I mean, is there a nation that's brilliant at the national team level but doesn't look at football for all? You know, doesn't have any kind of graduate. It might be.
I would argue that there are actually plenty. I mean, I spent a lot of time on this in writing my book, but there's plenty of examples of this. Portugal is actually one, I think, great example of it, where the facilities at grassroots level in Portugal really are not good. But what they do have is they have tremendous facilities for scouting and identifying players, and that's why they produce a great number of players.
There's a lot of points made from last week, and there's no real one way of being successful. I think history has taught us many things, that there are many styles and many types of, like you touched on, luck. You have penalty shootouts in major competitions that, you know, determine the winner.
Bad decision.
Yeah, bad decision, a wonder goal which comes out of nowhere. That's not all to do with just coaching, you know, and you see it in Champions League football as well. I've always felt that coaches' jobs are basically there to teach people how to play football at certain levels, and I mean that technically. I don't mean all the style and winning games and organisation. That should come way much further down the line.
You mean how do you pass the ball, how do you kick
absolutely.
The ball, how do you run with
now,
the ball?
A lot of people and a lot of ex-players will say this to me. Say, oh, I've done a coaching course and we're doing side foot passing. Oh, so boring. But that's where it all starts. Well, Jack Charlton used to do a thing. When he see players doing all juggling up and eddying up and keeping up 50 different ways and keeping up on their backside and whatever, he'd say, can you do this one? He'd put his hand on the ball and pass it 5 yards. And we'd all look and laugh because he was like, well, it's the easiest thing in the world. He said, not many people can do that.
That must have been the only time anyone in a Jack Charlton yeah. passed the ball
five yards. But what I was trying to... Look, when I first got to France, I started playing football tennis. At 31, I'm playing football tennis. And I realised within months why so many foreign players were so good with their feet and their heads in certain situations. Because I got really good at it. I used to play every day. And people come and watch me play when I was 31 and said, your touch is bloody improved. I said, my touch, I feel confident.
That's Tony Castorino giving you an insight into the tough life of a professional footballer in France.
But honestly, and I tell you, the guy's house I played regularly, and I used to play against him, was Platini. I used to play in Cassis at his house with Bruno Germain. I'm sure most of you might remember him, who played for Paris Saint-Germain and Marseille, won the Champions League. He would be my partner, and he was fantastic at head tennis. And I was rubbish. So I turn up, and I'm rubbish alongside him, and I'm playing. And
who's Platini's partner? Did he just need to play by himself?
He was Marcel Dib. Do you remember the lad Marcel Dib? Who was involved in Marseille, Monaco. We used to play against each other. And I can remember Platini, who was probably 6-7 years older than me and retired. He was doing things that I couldn't do. He's over the net, leaping and volleying it. And you'd think, this is how he got so many great goals. Mm. And do you know the guy that was on the sidelines who used to come on and play and everything? Papin. Jean-Pierre Papin used to be on the sideline. Never come in. And he was a guy that would get goals that I'd never seen before. And so I go back to it. It's all based around technique. That's what coaches' jobs are for me.
But Tony's absolutely right. And I think the problem with what Dyche said, I agree with Johnny. I thought it was quite a good speech. I thought he raised a lot of issues. And I think the realism that he introduced to it was important. I think England, as I said earlier, does need to realise where it stands in the world. And what it's not the case that England should go into every World Cup thinking, oh, we can win this. That's the worst thing England can do. But the issue is that what Dyche said, what Dan Ashworth's trying to do at the FA, there seems to be so many different competing agendas. Mm. Ashworth's spoken about trying to get a football culture with overlapping fullbacks, where everyone's comfortable on the ball, with rotating midfielders, with all this stuff. And that's fine, but that's not just a change of getting, you know, 3,000 more coaches.
But
that's
you've got to have the best personnel, Rory,
it's a massive cultural shift as well, because people say, oh, you know, we parents at youth level need to realise that it's not about winning, it's about the performance. Rubbish. It is about winning, but winning in the right way. You can't teach kids that it's okay to lose. But also, just one more point, Deb, it's about crowds at football matches. Yeah. I remember, I've been to countless games where you hear the crowd sort of getting a bit iffy. Does the manager bring in James Milner on and not a striker? I remember watching Liverpool play at Arsenal with Hesty, Owen, Fowler and Titi Kamara on the pitch, and that Houllier brought all four of them on. That was how they were 1-0 down, I think. That was how he was going to get a goal. And
I've never stuff like that. You guys all say he's a genius.
I've never seen a team look so toothless. Just there were loads of strikers, but no one to supply them. We need a cultural shift in how we understand football.
I think you guys are short-selling the fans a little bit. I think a lot of that is already...
It's changed
already. But I want to go back to this, Johnny, because you live in Liverpool, you live in the home of spiritual home of football. And I go back to these choices, right? So Cass is talking about coaches. We all know the stat about the number of A-licensed coaches. And
it's a false stat.
Blah, blah, blah. What false, real, whatever, right? There still is a finite amount of money there. And there is a choice between hiring 100 coaches and giving them a fair living wage for the rest of their lives and training them, obviously, and building 5 playing fields. And there is a choice about how you use those coaches. Would you get those qualified coaches to go and teach girls? Because that's not important, because the England women's team don't generate any money, right? And I kind of almost feel like these decisions, I don't even think the FA should be making. I think it should be political decisions. And I think we sort of muddy the argument a little bit when we put this on the FA, because they cannot be all things to all people. Since they get all these advantages and benefits from the government, I think it should be the government that decides we're going to have a nation of fit people where everybody, you know, every single person in the country is within 20 minutes of a 4G pitch and they can play whenever they like for close to free, and we'll benefit from this. Or we will try to develop our elites and give them the best coaching, and that'll inspire people that way. There is a trade-off there.
Facilities are one thing. The other thing that I think that no one seems to be addressing is how much it costs to play football now. Mm. It costs an absolute fortune. If you've got two or three kids, boys and girls, that you want to play for a team, that's a substantial drain on a family's resources if they're not making money.
You take just boots, nearly £200 for a decent pair of boots.
But then you have to pay
for kids.
You have to pay to play for teams. It's all very well the FA, and this is what Red Dyche's speech felt like a bit. Mm. They come in with these big ideas, these big pictures, but there is no desire or intent behind them to actually sort anything out. And that I think that's the impression I get with the FA. It's just an organisation totally mired in stasis.
The one other sort of populist thing that he came up with was when he talked about sort of the business of the loans and quotas and stuff like that. I think protectionism in football is very, very bad. I think it gives you a huge sort of illusion of what's going on. Post-Bosman, if you look at what happened in Germany, what happened in Spain, and what happened in Italy, at the time they all had roughly the same number. And these are all countries that have won things. They all had roughly the same percentage of foreigners as England did. And over time, that percentage then went down. They did a better job of producing their own players, not because anybody passed any quotas. Equally, when there was a high percentage of foreigners in this country, as there has been, between 2002 and 2006, that was the most successful period, or the second most successful period statistically for any England team ever, and that was with all the foreigners here. And it's simply because if there's a lot of foreigners, it means you're playing, presumably, against the best possible players that you're facing, if you're an England player. So, and there is one other knock-on effect, which nobody's been able to explain to me. The crowds in the Championship and in League One are as high as they've been since the late 60s, when there was no satellite television and no PlayStation and no internet,
seats.
Nothing to do. No seats either. Yes, good point. I think part of the reason is because there's very many very good English players who can't play in the Premier League because of the foreigners, so they move down to the Championship. And so the Championship is a fantastic league that everybody wants to watch, and then that has a knock-on effect on League One.
I don't think the quality's there, not in depth. I think there are good players in the Championship in League One and some in League Two, but it's not there in depth. There's a few that should come up, and the reason they don't is
I'm not suggesting it's there, but I'm saying that if you had the Dyke system, those guys would be sitting on the bench in the Premier League.
Would get worse,
and the Championship in League One would be worse.
I don't see how we can look at it and feel that bringing in better players is going to hinder our league. I don't get that. Yeah. If you're playing with the very best and you're training with the very best, you have to get better.
Right. I'm going to play devil's advocate here and give you the answer that all these protectionists always come up with. Well, Cass, I can understand it if you're bringing in Bergkamp or Zola or Cantona, but it's all those rubbish cheap imports.
But why do clubs go for cheap imports?
Because signing some guy nobody's ever heard of from Ipswich costs you £10 million.
Exactly. So the clubs,
and he can't play football because he's never had proper coaching.
But this is the problem. The clubs are thinking purely about themselves, which I suppose is their right. If the clubs are serious, the FA is serious about wanting to get more English talent into the top flight, make it economically viable. Football is an economy. And England is basically pricing itself out of the market.
I mean, there's a piece with Ray Wilkins in the paper today talking about Josh McCracken. Josh wasn't good enough to get into the Chelsea 11, that team. And he's not good enough to get into the England first team. People were using him to say, this kid is that good, he should be there. He wasn't making it. And not only just one manager, I think he had three at Chelsea. Never decided
Swansea.
To go with it.
Didn't make it at Swansea.
Yeah,
he didn't do well at Swansea.
I find that frustrating because I think it's an easy way out. I really do.
My final point would be, we'll have to ask, what is the English game? You know, the Premier League, like it or not, is as much the English game as the England national team, if not more. And, you know, ask the fans. Do the fans want to not see great foreign players playing for the clubs? Of course they don't. We've just had a transfer window where the clubs that didn't spend are the ones that were being criticised, and the clubs that did and brought in some great foreign players, you know, had celebrating supporters. So I think we've gone past the stage where there's any appetite for protectionism.
All right, time now for some quick hits. Cass, Everton signed James McCarthy to form a dream partnership with Ross Barkley. They had Gareth Barry's old head to the midfield. They can now pair Lukaku and Deulofeu up front and have Jelovic in reserve. And on top of everything else, they trick Manchester United into paying £20 million for Marouane Fellaini. They won the transfer window championship, didn't they?
Well, they had a player they could have let go in Fellaini for less, what, £4 million less a few weeks before. I like their business, I've got to say. I thought they'd done really well. And I'd be interested how James McCarthy does, because he played very well for Wigan. He was poor for Ireland on Friday, but he's a good player, and he's a player that I think Martinez will get the best out of.
On the flip side, Manchester United's final 24 hours of the transfer window were absurdly horrifying with the Ander Herrera and Marouane Fellaini debacles. And on top of that, the rumours that Sir Alex is going to pick some nasty bones when his new autobiography comes out next month. Johnny, you need to defend your boy. And no, you can't just blame everything on Ed Woodward, if only because nobody knows who the hell he is and what he looks like.
Well, he looks a bit like Ian Hislop, if you're confused. But the defence of United's transfer window would be terrible deadline day. Bigger picture, maybe not as bad as people think. The priorities were a left-back and a central midfielder. They did get one central midfielder who the manager very much believes in, and were only a few minutes away from getting Fabio Contrao on loan. On top of that, kept Wayne Rooney, which is going to be a big thing for them going forward. The overall reason for the lack of signings, I suppose, is really just that the manager is going to try and assess the squad. They've got a really, really big squad. All of this is justifiable if in the next window there's a churn of players, he decides which ones he wants to get rid of and does business early.
Rory made a face there when you mentioned Fabio Contrao, and I joined him in making that face. We mock United for spending £4 million more than necessary on Fellaini, but hey, Rory, didn't City kind of do the same when they spent £4 million on Demichelis when they could have signed him on a free? I want to know, what's the problem? Was Manuel Pellegrini somehow unaware that they might be shorthanded at the back and that Demichelis might just be available?
What City did with Demichelis was as bad as what United did with Fellaini, no question about that.
Yeah, we mock United, but we don't mock City.
I suppose the sums involved are bigger and maybe people didn't
quite
£4
million pounds?
No, I agree. Maybe people didn't know that Atletico Madrid had signed Demichelis on a free this summer, I think about 8 weeks before. I presume they had to get special dispensation from FIFA to do that as well, City.
I don't think so. I think because when you sign somebody on a free transfer, the two transfers don't apply.
Okay, quite why Pellegrini didn't work out that City might need another central defender and why he then tried to solve the problem by signing a terrible one, I'm not sure. But it may be that he wanted to assess the squad and it was only with the injury to Nastasic that he decided that he had to do something.
I think because we like Pellegrini and Moyes, we're all being exceedingly nice to them. But hey, it's the start of the season. We have plenty of time to get nasty. Arsenal sit on their hands all summer, but then they deliver Mesut Özil on the final day of the transfer window. Cass, no matter the disruption this may cause, surely they are better with Özil than without him, right? Top four side now, yes?
I'm not quite sure.
When you have 120 million odd in cash reserves, you know, it's...
Yeah, but Gab, he's been put alongside Dennis Bergkamp over, a decade in English football, was superb for Arsenal. I'm not quite sure. I've seen him a lot at Madrid. I think he has his moments. He's a talented guy. He's got good, you know, he's quick, but not blisteringly quick. He's technically good. He's in a great side of Real Madrid with some tremendous players around him. I just don't know if the transition going to Arsenal and the expectation that he's going to suddenly turn them into a top four team and maybe even a bit higher. I always felt with Ozil there was something always just slightly missing with him.
Well, they were a top four team last year, of course. And last 16 games, Arsenal, 13 wins, 2 draws, 1 defeat. Not so bad. Christian Eriksen is the final signing for Tottenham's huge summer transfer season, which saw them end up with a positive net spend. Brilliant. Johnny? Opinion on this guy is split. I'm guessing, though, that you're a fan of Mr. Eriksen.
I like him.
How did I know that?
He really wowed me when I saw him in the flesh against England in Copenhagen a couple of years ago. I really like him, and I think it was the right time for him to leave Holland because he maybe was starting to stagnate a little bit at Ajax. But I also like Lamella, and I'm not quite sure, and I also like Dembele, so I'm not quite sure who's going to play for Spurs. And looking at Spurs overall, I just wonder if, have they just done things slightly unbalancedly? They only brought in Roberto Soldado in terms of strikers, and they did pay a lot, what seemed to be slightly overpaying for him at £26 million. And that's about it, you know, apart from a sort of old Jermaine Defoe and a renegade Adebayor. So they've got these great players to play behind the striker, but they've only got one, and I'm not sure if he's going to, you know, I'm not sure Soldado alone would spear you into the top four.
All right, so a ridiculously wealthy Saudi prince buys half of Sheffield United for a single pound and pledges to invest in the Blades. Rory, you and I were talking about something recently, which we can't go into right now, but you're sort of from that part of the world. Is this a good idea for the resurrection of Yorkshire football?
Well, I mean, United are a great club, just like Wednesday are a great club. It's Sheffield's a proper football city. It would be brilliant if it was to work out, if Prince Abdullah could kind of finance them back to the Premier League to become a force. I think that would make the entirety of English football better to have a strong Sheffield team, hopefully two. I think all teams in the Premier League should be from Yorkshire. My only query is, there was a great interview with Nick Harris for the Mail on Sunday. They did a brilliant interview with him.
Am I right thinking, you can go to Nick Harris' personal website and read it that way?
The excellent sportingintelligence.com,
exactly.
Yeah, don't give the Mail your money. Yeah, the query would be, you kind of think, well, are you buying this for the right reasons? We've seen a lot of Middle East investment that's gone wrong. I interviewed Fawaz Al-Hassawi, who's the guy who owns Forest. And they were in kind of, where we did that interview was in kind of a similar sort of setting to where Prince Abdullah did his interview. I'm not sure that many Forest fans would be that sold on Al-Hassawi. I'm just a little bit suspicious of his motives. But hopefully for Sheffield United, it'll be the beginning of the beginning, because they are a great club, Sheffield United.
He is somebody who's, I think, realises he's very fortunate to be where he is and has worked at it and has done achieved things in his life.
And now, Gav, one for you. Next to my brilliant Colombia spread in the paper today is your column about Miroslav Klose. Why should I stop reading about Colombia and start reading about Miroslav Klose?
Because Miroslav Klose scored his 68th international goal against Austria, meaning that he's equaled Gerd Muller's record. And since they play the Faroes on Tuesday night, it's a fair bet that he may well break that record. The incredible thing about this, and I was actually recently talking about Klose with a former international striker, Tony Cascarino, actually, is just basically just talking about this guy's eye for goal, his longevity, and the fact that, you know, he's 35 years old. And he's still going strong at club level after he had 2 years where he scored 4 league goals in total for Bayern. And so they just kind of turfed him out, ends up at Lazio's, and he just keeps scoring for Germany. And the other interesting thing is, despite all this sucking up we do, the German model, the Germans, that's so cool, Germany can't produce any freaking strikers, which is why Miro Klose is still starting up front, because the only other striker they have is Mario Gomez. And now they've called up Max Kruse, who's 25 years old, and I think this is only his second cap, and he's really not that good either. So, you know, put that in your German suck-up system and pipe and smoke it. That's all we've got time for right now. But remember, you can catch Ahead of the Game, top analysis, and all the goals now if you subscribe to The Times. Go do it. Go do it right now. In fact, don't listen to the end of my outro, because remember, we want to hear from you. You can write to us, as so many of you do every single week, at gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. We also love it when you reach out to us on Twitter. Rory's on Twitter. Johnny, what's your Twitter handle?
Jay Northcroft.
Jay Northcroft. There you go. Feel free to interact with one of the many fake Cascarinos out there on Twitter. Just want to say thank you to everybody who joined me this week. Rory K. Smith, Tony Cascarino, Johnny Northcroft, and of course, our producer's done such a fine job stepping in for the extremely unreliable Chris Skinner this week. It's Mr. Dan Garlick. Till next time. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.